Okay. First, I thought I would just say how this all relates to what I do.
Rather.
Yeah. So I'm from a literature background, and obviously a lot of this isn't literature, even though there's literary elements in it. But I'm really interested, actually, about the relationship between the economic and the literary sphere. And as I've done more research, that's kind of become a bit more narrowed into the idea of imagination in relation to the economic sphere, which is, I'm sure as you can see from the readings, is relevant to a figure like Smith, but I'm also interested in how that translates in the turn of the century. So I've also looked at how imagination works in a utilitarian economist like David Ricardo, for example, and also maybe, I mean, I haven't gone that far, but also the obvious connection in Marx and, you know, Marx's reception to poetry and literary modes of thought as well. So I came across Mandeville because I've done some work on him in the past. I'm working a lot on Smith at the minute in relation to my work on Shelley because I'm a romanticist. I've tried to exorcise Shelley from this piece, though he does crop up later on. He comes up later on, so I couldn't do it totally. I'm sorry. But yeah, so this relationship between imagination and economics and economic systems as being kind of a product of a creative or dynamic imagination as well, if that makes sense. So I've got a short introduction here that I'll read out, and I've got relevant quotations on your handout, which I will indicate. I didn't set all the remarks for the Mandeville because they are quite lengthy and he does go on for quite a while, but I do refer to some of the later remarks in the talk as well, and we can talk about other aspects of the remarks if you've read that far, so I'll read this. So I've called the title of the session The Vile Ingredients of the Wholesome Mixture, which I think is quite a nice summary of Mandeville's ideas. Mm. So if we think about during the Age of Enlightenment, integrity was seen as synonymous with the inherently rational and benevolent propensities of human beings. In his essay concerning human understanding of 1689, John Locke declares that the individual is a conscious thinking thing, which is sensible of pleasure and pain, and so is concerned for itself as far as that consciousness extends. This view of the self as a composite of its sensory experiences and its consciousness of others is developed by Locke's successors. For instance, David Hume, who is a key figure of the Scottish Enlightenment, and I'll come back to in a moment, in his treatise on the principles of human nature, describes the mind as comprising vivid and intense chimeras, which recombine sense impressions in a way that resists conclusions matter of fact. Yet this session explores how two figures from either end of the 18th century not only challenge the idea that acting with integrity depends upon a rational subordination of the self, but also will analyse its relationship to socio-economic progress. Opening by reading Bernard Mandeville's most famous work, The Fable of the Bees, the paper investigates its controversial paradox that private vice is the catalyst to public benefit. Examining Mandeville's belief that to align social improvement with reason disregards humanity's essential nature, it considers whether he rejects integrity entirely or reorientates it in an alternative direction. The second part of the session explores the ways in which Mandevillian notions of integrity are transformed during the Scottish Enlightenment, which I mentioned a bit earlier on. Adam Smith's admiration for what he calls the kernel of truth in Mandeville's doctrines underpins his reinterpretation of self-interest in the Theory of Moral Sentiments of 1759 and in The Wealth of Nations in 1776. By tracing parallels between Smith's moral outlook and his seminal text on political economy, the session will explore the extent to which Mandeville's foundations shape his ideas about sympathy and national prosperity. So we're going to conclude by considering the legacy of Mandevillian and Smithian definitions of integrity in the early 19th century, particularly their impact upon Romantic era thought. And as I said, I haven't set any Romantic era writings, but there's some on the handout that we'll come back to. So by exploring such diverse attitudes towards human nature, the session considers to what extent integrity can be seen as a shifting concept during this period, as well as its influence upon the economic, legislative, and perhaps even aesthetic spheres. So Mandeville's fable comprises two separate works united in a single volume. He first published its poem, The Grumbling Hive, or Knaves Turned Honest, in 1705, a text that presents contemporary England as an allegory of worker bees in a corrupt yet prosperous hive. Ruled over by kings rather than being opposed by tyranny, or liberated by what he calls wild democracy, the bees are happy with their luxurious lifestyle, but are troubled by their lack of restraint. One day, a higher power grants their desire to be virtuous, resulting in an honest yet unprosperous society. The poem itself attracted little attention. Many readers overlooked the fact that Mandeville's rhyming couplets and employment of fable conceal sophisticated arguments about morality and economics. Yet when this was amalgamated with extensive prose expansions in 1714, it was denounced by the leading philosophers of the day. So I think we should return to why these two versions of Mandeville's ideas were interpreted in different ways. Yet the main reason that Mandeville's fable met with such hostility was that it depicted human nature as undermining Enlightenment ideals. From the outset, Mandeville insists upon the necessity of vice, arguing that society encourages human beings to cultivate their natural propensity for selfishness and ambition. He describes the vileness of the ingredients that altogether compose the wholesome mixture of a well-ordered society. Mandeville argues that it's only through embracing these vile qualities that society can advance towards a wholesome commercial economy. Unsurprisingly, the fable was inspired by contemporary debates about whether spending or saving was most beneficial to national prosperity. Going against the general belief that saving money could revive the economy in times of recession, Mandeville argues that spending on luxuries is not only vital to financial expansion, but also grows out of the human tendency towards self-aggrandisement. Whilst John Maynard Keynes, perhaps surprisingly, admires Mandeville for identifying this paradox of thrift, the latter's skill in linking financial questions with ideas about human nature has, I think, been relatively overlooked by present-day economics. Mandeville's belief that civilized man is a taught animal distinguishes between society and civilization. He regards society as beneficial due to the way that it nurtures the tendency to employ avarice and ambition in the cause of economic progress. In contrast, he perceives civilization as negative in relation to the artificial code of morality it teaches to human beings. An interesting example of this is his assessment of meat eating, which is in Remark Q, which he sees as arising from the advance of a rational civilization. Mandeville remarks, "We are born with a repugnancy to killing, and consequently the eating of animals, for it is impossible that a natural appetite should ever prompt us to do what we have an aversion to." This reveals, I think, his distinctive support for natural diet, which derives from the idea that an aversion to meat eating is the product of human selfishness. As he explains, "Nature taught your stomach to crave nothing but vegetables, but your fondness for change perverted your appetites." By connecting the perversion of self-interest with a fondness for living in civilized communities, Mandeville anticipates the arguments of revolutionary writers like Rousseau later in the century. Both condemn the distortion of the natural state by custom, but differ in their definitions of what human nature encompasses. Mandeville believes that without great vices is a vain utopia seated in the brain. Yet there's an instance in the fable where he contemplates whether humanity can develop beyond its inherent vice. Again, criticising the hypocrisy of a civilised society, he comments, "Our English law allows butchers not to be on any jury upon life and death, as the practice itself is sufficient to extinguish in them any tenderness." Mandeville argues that if society excludes butchers from jury service as a result of their desensitisation to death, it cannot allow meat to be consumed when its raw state causes aversion in self-interested beings. However, the notion that a butcher's profession extinguishes his natural tenderness marks a transition, I think, in Mandeville's argument. He appears to develop his belief in humanity's attraction to vice into the view that self-interestedness allows the individual to identify with other sentient beings. And again, this is maybe a bit of a contentious claim because Mandeville's talking about humans in relation to animals, not humans in relation to other humans. But I think it's quite interesting to see how these ideas do appeal to later figures like Smith when they're trying to think about human sentiments in relation to economics. So, having suggested that Mandeville rejects the idea of a rational humanity, it's important to investigate why he combines such moral inquiry with experiments in poetry and prose. F.B.K., who is the editor of your edition of Mandeville, comments that the fable of the bees is of import to not only the specialists in the history of economics and philosophy, but also to those whose interest is primarily literary, due to its concern with a wide range of thought. That Mandeville is equally as interested in literary expression as in economics becomes evident in his concept of readership, which reveals much about his authorial intentions. Mandeville's depiction of humans as animals attests to his literary skill, in that by expressing these views in fable, his allegory of worker bees contains a more subversive agenda than simply attracting readers to its unusual morality tale. By identifying the bees with different social classes, Mandeville presents an underlying economic argument that complicates this separation of poetry from prose. Whilst he mobilises poetry as social commentary, he experiments with different kinds of rhetoric in his prose annotations that compel its wide readership to examine their respective outlooks. Such a technique not only draws attention to the ways in which poetry and prose relate to each other, but also illuminates how political economy as a discipline emerged from moral and aesthetic questions that are perhaps alien to present-day economics. Mandeville's intelligent use of paradox can be observed in the poem, when he offers the reader a choice between a virtuous primitive existence and a corrupt yet prosperous society. He divides rhyming couplets by contemplating each scenario, such as in his description of the hive, "Every part was full of vice, yet the whole mass a paradise." Mandeville's skill in questioning whether the bees should sacrifice their commercial paradise for a virtuous society is expanded in the prose expansions. He comments, and yes, this is on your handout, "The first desirable blessing for any society are a fertile soil and happy climate, a mild government and more land than people. These things will render man honest and sincere, but they shall have no arts and sciences. They must be wholly destitute of what we call the comforts of life. Man never exerts himself but when he is roused by his desires." These observations not only emphasise that humanity is regulated by self-serving desires, but also anticipate the innovations of later political economists, which we'll come to in a moment. Mandeville's remarks about a fertile soil that can sustain small communities foreshadow the Malthusian argument that society can only be happy when its subsistence outstrips population. He presents such a society as an unobtainable ideal and asserts that human vice will always resurface, creating a contradiction between what is desirable and human desires themselves. In order to appreciate fully the impact of Mandeville's paradoxes upon this new discipline of political economy, it's important to explore the process through which his belief in the necessity of vice becomes transformed during the Scottish Enlightenment. Whilst Mandeville distrusts rational inquiry for what he sees as its suppression of human selfishness, he maintains that these propensities remain vile, notwithstanding their beneficial side effects. In the hands of a writer like Adam Smith, however, as I'm sure you've realised, Mandevillian notions of integrity become the catalyst for a mode of socio-economic progress based upon sympathy, codependence, and imagination. Although Smith admits that the fable borders upon the truth, his work realigns Mandeville's concept of vice with a virtuous definition of self-interest. Emma Rothschild, Ian MacLean, and Philip Connell, who are literary scholars, have compared the modern-day interpretation of Smith as a significant Enlightenment figure with the contemporary tendency to align his free market principles with anti-Jacobin politics. Yet the impact of Mandeville's fable upon these innovations must begin not with the wealth of nations, but with the theory of moral sentiments. Published in 1759, this work is distinctive for the ways in which it aligns Mandeville's views about human selfishness with an ethical system that centres upon imaginative sympathy. Both Hume and Dugald Stewart, two other significant figures of the Scottish Enlightenment, identify the role of imagination in shaping individual impressions of the external world. Yet Smith highlights its moral agency when he comments that it is by the imagination only that we can form any conception of the sensations of others, also on your handout. This is because only by imagining oneself in another's place can the selfish individual sympathise with the society at large. Smith's view of human nature as intrinsically self-interested and as a consequence intrinsically sympathetic is often regarded as, you know, potentially compatible with aesthetic ideas. For instance, James Chandler acknowledges that the reconstitution of the case that we find in Smith's moral philosophy is reiterated through much of what we think of as mainline romanticism. Yet such readings reflect a tendency amongst literary critics to admire Smith's progressive philosophy at the expense of analysing his economic innovations. The relevance of the theory of moral sentiments to Smith's labour theory of value, or the notion that value is defined by the labour required for its production, is partially understated. Smith conceived that a self-interested humanity was the catalyst not only to the individual's capacity to sympathise with others, but also to socio-economic expansion. This informs his conviction that a harmony of interests amongst different classes who all pursue personal gain could develop an economic model that benefits the manufacturer, landlord and labourer. Smith's progressive view of self-interest culminates in his seminal economic metaphor, the invisible hand, or the idea that we're often led to promote an end which is no part of our intentions. He anticipates this image in the theory of moral sentiments, which explains his acceptance of class divisions in the Wealth of Nations, commenting, "The rich consume little more than the poor, and in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity, though they mean only their own conveniency, they divide with them the produce of all their improvements." Smith's belief in the unintentional advantages that are gained by pursuing personal conveniency emphasises that self-interest contains a beneficial quality that can be applied to economic practice. Nevertheless, it's the imaginative process through which constructs this metaphor that's most interesting, especially in terms of the way that it not only fuses moral philosophy with a system of economic exchange, but also aligns this process with potentially aesthetic concerns. In this respect, we can kind of see full circle, he can be seen as developing Mandeville's early experiments with literary form into a mode of political economy that recognises how its imaginative propensities are unrestricted to the moral sphere. Smith's reimagining of political economy can be observed when he presents this progressive view of self-interest as an incentive to commercial growth. Like Mandeville, he is suspicious of the physiocratic belief that land is the only source of wealth, remarking that good roads, navigable rivers, put the remote part of the countries more nearly upon a level with those in the town. This alliance between country and town illuminates his belief that the interests of different classes can produce a dynamic form of mutual cooperation, even if this cannot level out social inequality. Nevertheless, his hatred of trade monopolies as limiting the capacity of every man to pursue his own economic interests casts the free market system in a semi-egalitarian light. Smith's core belief rests upon the uniform, constant, and uninterrupted effort of every man to better his own condition. That he connects this uninterrupted progress to national as well as private opulence reflects his belief that moral and economic development are interrelated. Although he died in 1790, it's significant that Smith's ideas are embraced by revolutionary figures. Radical millenarian Richard Price supports the egalitarian undertones of his labour theory of value, whilst Thomas Jefferson describes The Wealth of Nations as the best book to be read on the subjects of money and commerce. Ian MacLean remarks that in Smith's hands, economics becomes a radically egalitarian discipline, and this reading may be supported by a brief caveat on his legacy in the early 19th century. Following the failure of 1790s ideals, these self-interested definitions of integrity were viewed with increasing scepticism. Whilst Benthamite utilitarianism incorporates Scottish Enlightenment ethics to facilitate the greatest happiness for the greatest number, Romantic era writers like William Godwin and William Hazlitt question whether such a humanity can bring about this egalitarian system of government. I've got Godwin and Hazlitt both on the handout. Whilst Godwin's revolutionary inquiry concerning political justice of 1793 asserts that individuals can develop to a point where they forget their natural self-interest, Hazlitt's essay on the principles of human action of 1805 aligns an essentially disinterested view of humanity with republican politics. Nevertheless, it's significant that one of the most prominent romantic writers, Percy Shelley, incorporates Mandevillian and Smithian ideas into his work, specifically his theory of imagination. In his fragmentary speculations on morals and metaphysics, which were written roughly between 1817 and 1821, Shelley emphasises the importance of self-interest in both moral and socio-economic progress. He remarks, "We are intuitively conscious of our own existence. We are conscious also of the existence of other minds, but not intuitively." This idea that individuals are not intuitively aware of other minds highlights Shelley's rather surprising attraction to the self and its sympathetic qualities. His description of the imaginations of his predecessors as misguided appears to criticise Godwin and Hazlitt in their rejection of the self. Yet it also implies that the imaginative qualities within Smith and Mandeville's notions of integrity contain greater egalitarian potential than either proponent recognises. And whether such propensities can, in fact, be in line with the romantic outlook is something that I'll perhaps leave open to other people to think about. Thank you.